Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 40, A Virus Reborn. Futures in Biotech is brought to you by GoToMeeting, online meetings made easy. For a 30-day free trial of GoToMeeting on your PC or Mac, visit GoToMeeting.com/biotech.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there to be the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark. Years.
It's potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun's the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare it to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. I'm Mark Peltier. Today's episode is on the influenza virus. And to help me do the show, I invited Vincent Racaniello, and he's the host of a fantastic science podcast called This Week in Virology. He's also a professor of in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at Columbia University. So I feel that I've been lucky, and I brought out the big guns to help get a really clear understanding of influenza. So to our guest host, welcome.
Thanks, Mark. Happy to be here.
So could you tell us a little bit about Dr. Palese's work and why you thought that he would be the guest for this episode?
I've known Peter Palese for over 30 years. I actually did my PhD in his laboratory in the late 1970s on influenza virus. And interestingly, I was his first graduate student. And since then, he's had a stream of very good students and postdocs. He's done amazing work on influenza virus. He's covered almost every aspect of the field. He's done molecular biology, sequencing. He was the first to recover the virus from cloned copies, DNA copies of its genome. He's done pathogenesis, vaccinology, antivirals. He's done it all. So I thought, he has an incredible grasp on the whole field. He understands exactly what's going on. He's smart. He's a good speaker. He's engaging. So I thought it would be perfect since people are really fascinated by flu, as you know. It's in the news almost every day, and especially now that it's flu season. Vaccines, antivirals, avian influenza. I thought it would be a great topic, and he's just the perfect person to do it. And also, since I know him, I thought we could have a nice rapport as well.
Absolutely. And this virus, influenza, it really is, it should not be underestimated, right?
Absolutely not.
It kills in the tens of thousands per year in the U.S.
Right. It's quite a lethal virus, and that's why we get a lot of attention. It's quite lethal. It causes a lot of disease, especially in older and very young people. It can be quite lethal. It's a global problem. And as we'll see, every year it's a problem. It's seasonal. In temperate climates, you have outbreaks every year. So it's a significant pathogen. Not on the order of HIV, of course, but one of the runners-up in terms of viruses for sure.
We certainly shouldn't forget about it. It should be right up there, especially considering that every either 100 years or 1,000 years, there can be a pandemic, right, which can kill millions.
Well, since 1890, we've had six pandemics. You know, there used to be every 10 to 20 years. It was, say, there was one in 1918, then 1957, 1968 was really the last pandemic. So we're due for one now. And, you know, everyone's guessing what strain it will be. That's always the problem, because the pandemic is a pandemic because you have a whole new strain or subtype of influenza that appears. And some people think it might be these H5N1 avian strains that are very lethal in chickens and turkeys. But no one knows. And that's part of the fascination with the virus.
And one of the topics we're going to talk about is the 1918 strain. And Dr. Pelezi was involved in recreating that strain so that it would be available in the laboratory.
Right. That's an amazing story. And as he will tell you, it was recovered from just the sequence. And where the sequence came from is even more amazing. But we'll let him tell us that.
Absolutely. Let's get right to it. How does a virus in the life sciences compare to a virus in the information technology world? Is it the same thing? Is it a question of information that's gone haywire?
Viruses basically no good. Yeah. In contrast to bacteria, viruses appear to really take advantage of cells and of, in our case, obviously most important, of humans, where they replicate and cause damage. And they really also need for replication the human cell and a live human being. So in that sense, the virus, which we are all afraid of in computers, is very similar. These computer viruses would not be able to be replicated without the internet, without the computer age, and therefore, and I think in most instances, these viruses are no good. So I think there are some similarities, but obviously, clearly, there are also big differences.
May I interject, Mark? One difference, of course, is computer viruses are made by people. And the biological kinds, well, they evolved.
Well, they evolved, but are they living? Are they? Is a virus considered a living organism?
I would say absolutely not. And I don't know. I'm sure Peter would agree.
Let me disagree with Professor Racaniello. It really depends how life is being defined. If one defines it as someone who can speak, laugh, and interact, or is something which is replicating and then speaks, thinks, and does all the things we are doing, then obviously a virus is not life. But if we define it more stringently and have a sort of definition which would include copying of information, then I think one can assign quote life quote to a virus as well.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the anatomy of a virus, and or perhaps some of the anatomies, because there's many forms of viruses. What are the how is a virus built? Is it just genetic material? Is there protein involved?
The major component of a virus, in my opinion, is the genetic material. In other words, the information which tells the virus what to do, and that can be either DNA or can be RNA. And that, I think, is the most important. Obviously, there are other components in viruses, including proteins, including in many instances lipids, carbohydrates. So these are all different components, but I think the most important is the genetic information of the virus.
Yeah, I guess you could view everything else as sort of a carrier for that genetic information. The proteins, carbohydrates, lipids, all they do is bring it from one host to another, right?
Correct.
What scale is a virus compared to a cell? These are very basic. I'm letting the audience
sure.
hear
it. Sure. No, this basic. Is. I always try to sort of tell the students when we project an image, a electron micrograph, or even if it's just a diagram of a virus on a screen, and then how big compared to that screen virus to that virus on the screen, how big would be a cell in comparison? Blown up to the same scale. And people are always, and students are always surprised how small viruses really are as compared to the cell which gets infected. And one can have this image: if you blow up a virus, let's say to the size of a fist, then the cell, and obviously it depends on the virus and depends on the cell, but the virus then may have, the virus which has the size of a fist may infect a cell which is half the Empire State Building. So it's really a tremendous size difference.
Wow.
Between a virus and a cell. And again, depending on how big the virus is, some are smaller, some are bigger. But that sort of shows that within one virus particle infecting half the Empire State Building may within 8 hours basically change the entire
wow.
machinery of the Empire State Building and basically kill it within 8 hours and produce 100,000 or a million new virus particles in that very brief period of time of 8 hours.
That's amazing. Nice. That's absolutely amazing. You know, I'm astonished, and I've seen viral particles in electron microscopy images, and I never really put that scale together. And it's the amazing ability to overtake the life processes of a cell to destroy it in 8 hours from such a small scale is absolutely astounding.
It's astounding for a non-living thing.
Or living. All right. That's a great, or a non-evolving thing, or evolving. It's certainly evolving.
Oh, absolutely evolving, no question.
Is that
Peter and I will agree that viruses do evolve.
Yes.
Is that grand ability to take over the life processes fast, extremely fast, give the virus the world's fastest process of evolution?
A very good question. Clearly, viruses, and particularly if we talk about bacterial viruses, evolve at an unprecedented speed. So I think, if we talk about biology, probably viral systems are the fastest evolving ones. And some of us still believe in Darwinian evolution, and I think it is sort of very clear that many viral systems really follow a very straightforward Darwinian evolutionary pathway, particularly, for example, influenza viruses are a sort of almost a textbook example of how a Darwinian evolution works.
So maybe it would be a good time to talk a little bit about influenza. You know, everybody uses the term the flu, but it is so misunderstood. Some people confuse the flu with a cold and or even a bacterial infection with a viral infection. Maybe the flu would be a really good way to sort of clean up that. And I don't understand why. Maybe viruses are that elusive in our mindset. Perhaps you could describe a little bit what the flu is from maybe the viral anatomy and then how it creates pathology.
So particularly when we talk about respiratory infections, humans can be infected by bacteria and by viruses causing sometimes very similar symptoms. Clearly, bacteria are very different from viruses. Antibiotics only work on bacteria, which are, and if we talk about live or not live, bacteria can certainly replicate on their own, on an agar plate, on cheese, in some instances, on any sugar fluid substrate. So bacteria are really different from viruses, but they can cause, if we talk about respiratory diseases, they can cause very similar symptoms and very similar disease. But they are really very different animals, so to speak, very different organisms. But then if we go to viruses, which are not able to replicate on their own, they always need a cell to take advantage of, to invade, to replicate in those living cells. But if we talk about viruses causing respiratory diseases, we can, again, think of many different viruses. If we look at influenza viruses, which are the agents causing influenza, they are probably responsible for the more severe respiratory infections. But there are also many other viruses which can cause respiratory illness, respiratory diseases, and those are, you referred to them already, common cold viruses, those are rhinoviruses, but there are also other viruses, such as adenoviruses, which are also associated with those kinds of respiratory diseases. So influenza is sort of a famous virus to cause respiratory disease, severe respiratory disease, in particularly the young ones, infants, as well as the old ones and immune-compromised population. But we should not forget that there are other agents, in addition to bacteria, other viral agents such as adenoviruses, rhinoviruses, or common cold viruses, which can, in addition to influenza, cause those kinds of symptoms.
So why is it that influenza is the most notorious of all the viral respiratory infections?
Because in general, more hospitalizations are associated with influenza disease. Also because the virus has a seasonality, meaning that particularly in the winter month, influenza is more prevalent. That means over a very short period of time, a lot of the epidemic disease, respiratory disease, is caused by influenza viruses, whereas some of the other viruses are year-round, and the frequency within a short period of time, December to February, March, is much more dramatic in terms of influenza virus infections.
How many people are affected by influenza in the U.S. per year?
It's probably maybe 5 to 10% of the people get influenza in the U.S., and this is associated with a large number of hospitalizations, more than 100,000, and the numbers of people who die as a result of infections by influenza viruses is very high. So the estimates coming from the Center for Disease Control are that about 30,000 people die per season, per year, of influenza virus infections, which are then in many instances are followed by bacterial infections. But the end result is death, unfortunately.
Why is flu more severe than other respiratory infections?
That's a $64,000 question. It probably has to do with the virus causing damage in the respiratory tract, inducing cytokines which are associated with inflammation. Influenza viruses are really very locally, in a sense. They are really only replicating in the respiratory tract. So one cannot find virus in the in blood, in serum. It doesn't replicate in my left toe. It really is associated with replication in the upper and, unfortunately, when it gets severe, in the lower respiratory tract. So one explanation is that where the virus replicates, that is, influenza viruses like to, or severe influenza virus infections are associated with growth of the virus in the lung. And that obviously can lead to emphysema and severe consequences.
I have two questions, and they're completely unrelated. The first question is, what was probably the best way to distinguish between an upper respiratory tract infection from a cold or from influenza? Is there a way to distinguish right away within a day of?
In terms of symptoms, mild influenza can look exactly like a mild cold caused by rhinoviruses. So clinically, there is it is not easy to distinguish. So the basically impossible many times. The seasonality helps a physician to diagnose influenza because if that's a 15th patient coming in having the same symptoms and the diagnosis was done by testing in the first case, so then it's likely that the remaining 14 also have come down with influenza virus infections. But just from the clinical picture, it's not that easy to distinguish between common cold or adenovirus infections and influenza virus infections.
Does influenza cause a fever, more of a fever? Is it more?
Fever is one of the manifestations of influenza virus infections, but again, the whole spectrum can be seen. Basically, subclinical, aclinical, no fever, and then to severe fever where people are really close to death, and that is unfortunately part of the picture of influenza virus infections. It's not only a question of the virus itself, but also the immune status of the patient. In other words, if a similar virus has been seen by that patient, then there is some immune protection, and therefore the subsequent infection by influenza viruses will be milder. So even a, let's say, what we call virulent, pathogenic, a bad influenza virus may cause mild disease in one patient and a much more severe disease in another patient.
So you mentioned a person having seen that virus strain and then perhaps getting a less severe infection. Is this a good argument for vaccination? I mean, even in the medical community, I know a lot of medical doctors, a lot of scientists that would say forego vaccination. Whereas I tend to get the vaccine regardless because I feel that even in the slight chance that I get influenza, I don't have a week to take off, even though I know that I'd be fairly confident that I could survive it. I'm wondering, maybe you could help us decide, is it a good idea or should we, is it necessary or does it help the community around us or the people around us to get vaccinated?
You unfortunately touched upon a very important issue that many healthcare workers, people working in the healthcare field, are not convinced that influenza virus vaccination is a good thing. Unfortunately, that's very wrong, and there is clearly no evidence that there are any adverse reactions, side effects caused by the current influenza, by the current FDA licensed influenza virus vaccines. Unfortunately, not enough people are willing to take the vaccine. I always say, if you want to get sick, then don't take the vaccine. Clearly, influenza virus vaccination is very important for, in essence, all populations. Influenza virus vaccines are not 100% effective, and we can talk about that, but they are certainly effective depending on the strain, on the year, more than 60-70% of the time, and it is clearly a medical measurement, we certainly should take advantage of this armamentarium in terms of making us healthier, making us not come down unnecessarily with an influenza virus infection. So clearly, vaccination is very important. There is no good reason why people should not take it.
Peter, what is the coverage in the U.S.? How many people get the vaccine, do you know?
I think the coverage has increased, and it's about 50% now.
Do you think it would make a difference, this attitude? You know, we have a generally anti-vaccine attitude, unfortunately, growing. Do you think it would make a difference if you could get one flu shot and it would last your lifetime?
That would make life certainly easier. However, I'm not sure that in our lifetime, maybe Dr. Professor Racaniello may still see a universal influenza virus vaccine. Mark Pelletier, you may also be fortunate enough to see that, but I'm not sure that this is around the corner. It would make life much easier, obviously, and it would really be a tremendous advantage to have. Let's not even aim for a lifetime, but for a vaccination which would last and give coverage for, let's say, 10 years. Even that would already be a major improvement. And there is some hope, but I'm not so sure it's will be next year or the year after.
Has, with the increase of vaccinations, the trend towards vaccinations, has that correlated? I mean, this is an epidemiology question. Has it correlated with a lower incidence? By having, two people out of every family get vaccinated, does that prevent the spread of the virus to the rest of the community?
Those numbers are not that easy to come by, but there have been studies in Texas where they have used similar school districts in terms of population density, ethnicity, etc. And there it was very clear that when school children were vaccinated in one district and not in another, that in that district there was much less influenza in the adult population in that particular year. So I think I would like to answer your question with yes, there is protection not only for the individual who gets the vaccine, but also for people surrounding that individual, meaning family members, schools are more protected, etc. So clearly, a more universal coverage would, in my opinion, really change the picture in terms of overall influenza virus infections.
So, Peter, you mentioned, or maybe you didn't, but I'll ask it, the two sort of related questions. Why do we need to get a vaccine every year? And if that's the case, how is it? How do people decide which vaccine we need to get?
So one of the hallmarks of influenza is that the virus changes from year to year. In other words, the virus which is circulating in March of 2009 is different from the virus which will circulate a year from now or 2 years from now. So we can not completely predict what the next year, what next year's strain will be. However, by knowing what will circulate during the summer month, August, in the southern hemisphere, we have a fairly good picture of the strains which will probably be around in March 2010. So by preempting hoping that those strains are similar to those which were 6 months earlier on the in the southern hemisphere, it is possible to predict what kind of strains will be prevalent, and vaccines or the vaccine formulations take into account those kinds of strains. And that means that every year or every other year, the components of the influenza virus vaccine are changed. They are actually, it's complicated. There are two influenza A viruses and one influenza B virus is part of the vaccine over the last probably 30 years. And they have to be changed every year, every other year to take account of the ever-changing virus. And that is very different to, for example, poliovirus or measles virus, where the virus does not change. And even though these poliovirus, measles virus, influenza viruses are all RNA viruses, only influenza viruses really change that dramatically.
Why is that?
That's a very good question. And I don't think there's a good answer for it. You know, one of the possibilities is that the virus, the structure of the virus, the architecture, doesn't permit variation. But this is sort of a lame argument. I think it's not really that clear why influenza virus changes more than other viruses. But that's what we have to live with.
One quick question. This may be a stupid question, but do the people in the Southern Hemisphere look to the Northern Hemisphere to predict what kind of vaccine they should be making?
Correct. The same thing. Yeah, because they have they have half a year sort of advance notice from what happens to them. Yes,
wow. Correct. Has aviation affected that?
I'm sorry?
Has aviation, you know, people traveling back and forth?
Yeah, strangely enough, even though if there's a plane load of Australians coming in August, they are not shedding enough influenza virus so that it can take hold and that we have an epidemic. So that is only in very rare instances, for example, on boats, on pleasure boats, you know, these boats where 3,000-4,000 people are in very close quarters. In those instances, influenza outbreaks have also been demonstrated during the summer month. But in general, it does not happen. There is this seasonality.
Wow.
So the use of the northern and southern hemisphere strains implies that there is trafficking of viruses north-south and south-north. So if it's not Australians on an airplane bringing them, who's responsible or what is responsible for the mixing of the strains?
It's it is traveling, I'm sure. I mean, if it's not on the plane, then boats, etc. So there is clearly, one can prove that these viruses are very similar, which are found in different hemispheres.
But it has nothing to do with aquatic birds bringing the viruses back and forth?
There is a component of aquatic birds in terms of mixing genes into different influenza viruses, but not for the seasonal ones.
Mm-hmm, I see.
You are absolutely correct. If we talk about human influenza, we have to take into account that also animals carry influenza viruses, and occasionally there is a mixing of animal influenza virus genes with those of human influenza virus genes. And an exchange occurs, but that is very rare. And that usually leads to a pandemic strain, to a strain which is a new one, which can cause a lot of damage, like the 1918 pandemic, which was responsible for 50 million people death. In the case of regular seasonal influenza, the animal reservoir is probably not of any significance. There it appears it's really a mixing among different human populations, which results in the transfer and transmission of different influenza viruses from north to south or south to north.
I'd like to take a minute to thank GoToMeeting for sponsoring Futures in Biotech. As I've mentioned in past shows, GoToMeeting is an excellent tool for scientists. It allows you to, one, share your data with collaborators, or two, get advice on how to better analyze your data without leaving your lab or your office. GoToMeeting can be summarized as online meetings made easy. And having your meetings online instead of in person saves you time and money. There's no travel or expenses that are incurred. It increases your productivity because you can do more when you travel less. And it's very convenient. You can have meetings right from your office, you can do them from home, you can do them pretty much from anywhere. And now it's available for both PCs and Macs. It's easy to set up, just takes about 2 minutes, it's safe and secure, and there's a low, flat, monthly rate.
But right now, there's a 30-day free trial, 1 month of free service, unlimited meetings. That's as many meetings as you want. You just have to go visit gotomeeting.com/biotech. Now, back to the interview.
What are the structural changes that would be dramatic that would allow the virus to evade the immune system? And maybe we could get a little picture here. Now we know that a virus is the size of a fist versus a half the Empire State Building. Now, maybe if we could describe what that fist looks like.
Yeah. So influenza virus particles, like many other viruses, are round, spherical particles. And in terms of what the immune system sees is really just the outside. And there is one protein which we refer to as heme agglutinin. It's a technical term because it agglutinates red blood cells, heme agglutinin. And that is the protein which is decorating the outside of this round virus particle. And that is what is seen by our immune system. And if we get vaccinated with such a virus, then we make an immune response against this hemagglutinin. Now, so that is good if we can make a vaccine and if we get, and then we make an immune response which is protective against another, a subsequent infection. On the other hand, if the virus changes this hemagglutinin, then the virus is not recognized anymore by our protective immune system, and the virus can infect us and cause disease. So, yes, this one, and it's really basically one protein, one structure on the surface of the virus, which is the important one in terms of immune response. If that changes, we have we call this immune evasion, and then the virus particle cannot be protected. And in those very rare instances where a completely new outside hemagglutinin occurs, and that is a result of this mixing of animal influenza virus strains with human influenza virus strains, then a completely different hemagglutinin is present on the surface of the virus, and that leads to, can lead to viruses which run rampant around the world and cause a global epidemic, or we also refer to this as a pandemic, a global epidemic.
So influenza or hemagglutinin, sorry, it has the ability to mutate to such an extent that it can avoid our cells' ability to detect it and destroy it, but still remain functional?
Yes, that is one of the unique properties of the virus, that despite being an influenza virus, despite doing all the things the influenza virus does, it can change enough so that the immune system doesn't recognize it anymore. So that's a very unique property of influenza viruses. Unfortunately, such a property is also shared by HIV, and we all know that variation there is another big problem in terms of making or developing an HIV effective vaccine.
So, Peter, the if the virus is a fist, the hemagglutinins are sort of the size of fingers, would you say?
Yeah, yeah, probably, yes.
Okay,
short fingers. Yeah.
So, how big is the change that would allow evasion of a strain from an immune response on that finger? How would you make the metaphor?
It's
a hair,
basically putting nail polish on. Okay. So having they're fairly small changes which can lead to a masking of the important sites which are recognized by the immune system. So it's really, I mean, yes, red color, green color, that all makes the immune system not recognize anymore the influenza virus.
So in a little more detail, how many amino acid changes would that be?
It could be 3 to 4 amino acid changes only.
Yeah, it's amazing.
How big is the protein in amino acids?
at about 700 amino acids, so it's less than 1%.
So for the audience, a protein is made of a chain of amino acids that coil upon themselves, and that three-dimensional coil gives it its function. So you're saying that out of those 700 amino acids, three or four changes are significant enough that the virus can then run around our immune system, do circles around it.
Yes, correct, and cause disease. That's the main problem, that it is unencumbered by any protective immune response of our host immune system, and replicates without any check and balance.
So you mentioned this 1918 pandemic, and you mentioned a number of 50 million deaths from that. Is that correct?
Yes. So it's remarkable that within a very short period of time, namely December of 1918 to about February, March of 1919, in this very 2.5-3 month period, basically 50 million people died worldwide. Most of the people, even today and also around 1918, 1919, live in the northern hemisphere. So that's why the number of 50 million is associated with that period of the winter time of 1918-1919, December to February, March. And that virus, within this very brief period of time, as a combination of a very virulent virus and a new surface, a new hemagglutinin, against which no one at that time had any immune protection, resulted in this very devastating event, namely the pandemic of 1918-1919.
So that virus is apparently much more virulent than any of the subsequent pandemic strains. Do we understand why that's so?
It's probably one of a century or one of a millennium even, virus, which just had the right mixture of genes, the right amino acid sequences, and it was really more virulent than other seasonal and other pandemic influenza virus strains, which we have been able to study in the laboratory.
So when I was a student, we didn't have that virus around, but since then, it's been reconstructed in the laboratory, and what do we learn from that?
So the virus, influenza viruses, have been isolated for the last 70 years. So starting in the 1930s, influenza viruses have been obtained from the throat of infected patients. And some of those are still available in refrigerators and freezers in different laboratories. But the 1918 influenza virus is extinct, was not, one didn't even know at the time whether the disease was caused by bacteria or other agents, because science was not at a stage which could distinguish and identify the etiological agent, the agent which was responsible for this disease. So the virus is gone. But by having pathology specimens, and particularly the U.S. Army had material from soldiers who died in 1918 stored as pathology samples, and they are actually preserved in a paraffin block. So they took samples from lungs and other organs of patients, soldiers who died at that time, and then stored them in archives of the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology at the Walter Reed Hospital in Washington. And using those specimens, Taubenberger, who was working at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, was able, using modern technologies, to get the sequence of the RNA of the nucleic acid of the genetic information of the 1918 virus, and then techniques which we have developed at Mount Sinai allowed us then to reconstruct based on the sequence. So we didn't use any component of the virus from 1918 other than the information what the sequence was, what the amino acid sequence was, what the nucleotide sequence was, and then made in the laboratory virus, and this virus is infectious, and we can study it now in very effective ways.
But which we presume is the same as this strain that circulated in 1918. So it's not synthetic in the sense that it didn't exist before.
Yes, yes. It is really a reconstruction. And we would say, because it really is more virulent, more pathogenic than any other influenza virus which we have in the laboratory, we believe that this is really the same virus as 1918.
So you must have to work with this virus under very contained conditions.
So the first, there are very strict rules and regulations under which we can work with the virus or even a gene from that virus. And these are high containment facilities which are designed to protect people who are working in those facilities on one hand, but also obviously make sure that the virus does not escape, does not jump into an animal reservoir, or even worse, that people would get infected.
Yeah, as however, you know, sorry, go ahead.
However, I would like to say that even though the 1918 virus was devastating in 1918, we were able to show that the virus is, one, sensitive to FDA-approved drugs, Tamiflu and other approved, and also vaccines, but also that all people have been exposed to similar viruses since that time. So we are actually not, even if such virus would be infecting humans today, the consequences would not be as dire and as severe as they were in 1918, because we all have some partial protection against these H1 viruses, which the 1918 was the first one.
You know, certainly we don't want to let it out, right? And in fact, many people have suggested that it wasn't a good idea to recover this strain because accidents do happen. So how would you make them, besides telling us about the antivirals and vaccines, how would you make them feel better?
I think virus, to know what made this virus so bad, I think is very, very important information. And then if we know what this virus was all about, it allows us, one, to really find drugs and medications against it on one hand, but also understand what we have to sort of do in terms of preventing the outbreak of another one of these very dangerous viruses. So I think under the right circumstances, under the right restricting laboratory conditions, I think it is important to continue such studies, because the benefit of the knowledge, what we can learn from studying these viruses, outweighs any kind of potential danger.
So in that vein, then, would you say we should keep the remaining stocks of smallpox?
I am one of the people who feels that the importance of knowing what this virus is, you know, is outweighs the potential danger which such a storing of the virus might bring along. I think it is more important to really have the right medications and the knowledge how we can prevent a smallpox disease, that we get better drugs, better vaccines in the future. That's more important than being afraid, particularly as there are other pox viruses in nature which may jump into humans. And if we just stop research in this area, I think we will be the damage will be much bigger than not studying such viruses.
The pool of viruses out there in the world is enormous, right? I think we did an episode, episode 9, with an MIT professor who was describing the ecology of just bacteriophage in the oceans 100 miles north of Hawaii. And he said that there was 10 times more phage, or 100 times, 10 to 100 times more phage per milliliter than bacteria, and there was billions of bacterial cells in the per ml.
It's 10% of the mass of the ocean is bacteria, and yeah. a million bacteriophages per milliliter of ocean water.
Something enormous numbers. Wow, that's amazing. So, you know, understanding this is going to be could save humanity, absolutely.
Yeah, I think putting the head into the sand and ignoring these viruses and not working on them, I think, is more dangerous than doing it under the right conditions and working in the right facilities.
So, Mark, can I ask one more?
Ooh, sure. It's not up to me.
I don't want to.
There's no problem. This is fantastic.
So, Peter, why is flu seasonal?
So, the influenza virus is in the northern hemisphere limited to really a 2 or 3 month span, depending on the year, maybe starting in November and then going for 2 or 3 months. And in the southern hemisphere, in their winter time, which is July, August, September. And so this has been observed for many, many decades since surveillance has become more scientific. And people have sort of always known about this, but we did not have a real molecular explanation for that. And recently we have developed a system in the laboratory which allows us to look at transmission. So the question is, what are the molecular signatures? What are the precise conditions which determine whether a virus can be transmitted from one patient to the other, from one human being to the other? And such experiments cannot be done because of ethical considerations. We just can't take 20 medical students and put them into a room and infect one and then check what determines how fast the virus can be transmitted. So these experiments were possible maybe 30, 40 years ago, but clearly we cannot do them anymore because there is no benefit for the person for the person in this trial. So what we can do, however, is to have animal models in which to study this. And we developed a animal model, which is the guinea pig. And we have two cages, which are separated by several feet. And we put an animal infected in one cage and another animal. Usually we take many more animals, but another cage with another animal which is uninfected, and then we ask the question, how easy is it to get transmission from the infected animal to the uninfected? And it turns out that if we do this transmission under cold temperature, the temperature which is during the winter time, and under low relative humidity, which is also imitating winter conditions, and we leave animals there for 7 to 10 days, we observe that transmission of influenza viruses is much easier at cold temperatures, 5 degrees centigrade, as compared to room temperature or even higher temperature. At 30 degrees, something like 80 something Fahrenheit, there is no transmission whatsoever. So that, I think, is one of the, I think, explanation, maybe the explanations, why we do have seasonality with influenza virus. Transmission, which is important because one person infected doesn't start an epidemic, but transmission appears to be much more effective at low temperature and low relative humidity. And those are the conditions which prevail during the summer, during the winter time. And this, I believe, is one of the, well, is probably the most important factor which explains this seasonality.
So does this mean we should keep our homes well humidified in the winter to stop transmission?
If we could keep our rooms at 80 degrees and high humidity, we would prevent influenza virus transmission, but we would probably buy a lot of other infections, bacterial, et cetera, not to speak of the cost, et cetera. So this is not a practical solution. We can simply, we cannot for obvious reasons heat up all the rooms, and also we cannot change the humidity. And clearly, if you would go out on the street or in the elevator or in the subway, we couldn't keep those conditions up. So yeah, this is not a practical consideration really, but I think it sort of gives us an explanation why we have more transmission during the winter time.
So why does high low humidity improve transmission?
Yes. So the it's both low temperature and low humidity. One, the virus is probably more stable at low temperature and low humidity. There is some evidence that the virus does have a lipid membrane, and that lipid membrane undergoes what they call a phase shift. And that is, once it goes under 30 degrees centigrade, the virus becomes more rubbery and probably more physically more stable against rupture and against spilling its guts, so to speak. So it is a question of the physical stability of the virus at low temperature, low humidity on one hand, and probably also the host is changed under those different conditions, that there is a ciliary movement which is probably slowed down when it's cold outside, meaning that the virus is not cleared as easily. The mucus is more viscous, which also leads to a longer carrying of the virus and therefore a higher probability of transmitting it from one patient to the other. So it's both stability of the virus on one hand and changed condition in the respiratory tract, which are inducible to a longer virus shedding.
I do have a question with respect to influenza versus adenovirus. If influenza has such an amazing ability to target to the upper respiratory tract, and as you mentioned, not to the toes, is influenza a possible candidate for gene therapy? Will it be used to carry genes into the upper respiratory tract to, one, maybe produce anti-apoptotic agents for cancer, or for delivering the cystic fibrosis gene, the CFTR, the correct version to patients with cystic fibrosis? Or is adenovirus really going to be the vector of choice? Is it too hard to engineer influenza?
It is harder to engineer influenza viruses as compared to adenoviruses. But I think even with adenoviruses, there are limitations to how often we can deliver such a virus, or how often we can administer those genetically engineered viruses in order to deliver a particular gene. And it is, I think, still some time off before we can think about these viruses as good vehicles to express transgenes. So I think, in essence, influenza viruses would also be possible to be used for such transfer of genes as adenovirus is used. It might also be used in terms of oncolytic, as an oncolytic agent to possibly attack cancer. In all of these cases, however, the immune system is something which is important, as we talked about. That's why vaccines work, and that's why we are protected. But the same kind of immune response may also make it less easy to use these viruses as vaccine, as vectors, and as oncolytic agents.
We fight them, so we'd be fighting the medicine.
Exactly, yes.
I suppose one last thing that we should mention, though, I mean, we talked a lot about vaccines, and we didn't mention how they are made. And while they're safe, and there's no literature out there that suggests that they are not safe to take. My son is allergic to eggs. He's deadly allergic to eggs. So we always have him watched when he gets his vaccine. So I guess I would, you know, tell people, you know, if they're concerned, just they should really only be concerned about their egg allergy. If they're allergic to eggs, then they should talk to the doctor about vaccination.
There is the current manufacturing procedure for influenza virus vaccines involves growth in embryonated eggs, and therefore people who are allergic against products, chicken, poultry products, components are unfortunately in a position where it might not, where they could have some side effects. It might be possible also to use a live virus vaccine, which is given through the nose, where there might be less of a allergic reaction as compared to injecting the vaccine. Wow. So that might be a way for people who have allergies against chicken components. So there is some way of avoiding that. And also in the future, influenza virus vaccines will be produced in tissue culture, human cells or higher primate cells, and there would be no possibility that any chicken product would be in those vaccines.
Oh, great.
Would that be in our lifetime, Peter?
That one will be in our lifetime, yes.
Is it in Vincent's lab? Does he have one? He was mentioning he was growing HeLa cells, so...
Those are the kinds of cells which will be used, yes.
Fantastic. Well, I think this is absolutely fantastic. It's a great service to everyone listening, and to myself included, to clear up a little bit of the, you know, some of the mystery behind influenza. And it's just a very mysterious virus, and now I really feel that I can get a clear understanding here. So I'd like to thank you both for being on the show. I really, really appreciate, and I'm honored that you accepted the invitation.
Thank you. It was my pleasure and my honor for both. Thank you very much, Vincent. Thank you very much, Mark.
Nice to hear you again.
Okay. Thank you very much.
So I'd really like to thank Dr. Pallese for his time today. And I'd also like to thank Dr. Vincent Racaniello, the host of the great science podcast called This Week in Virology. It's one that I listen to, and the reason why I really wanted you on the show is to help us get a better overall understanding of viruses so that we don't fear them as much. You know, knowing that scientists like Dr. Pallese and yourself are working on this, it gives me a lot more confidence to get out there and mingle, I suppose, during flu season. Could you tell us a little bit about your podcast, This Week in Virology?
This Week in Virology, I started back in September of 2008. I had for a long time been listening to the TWIT podcasts, and I thought they were a fabulous way to convey enthusiasm about a topic. And I always wanted to do that with viruses. And I was having lunch one day with my colleague, Dick Despommiers, and I told him, and he said, well, let's start it next week. So I went to his office with a little recorder and two mics, and he knew a lot about West Nile virus, so that was our first episode. And the goal is simply to have a few people, very much like Twit, who know something about viruses, to have a conversation every week. And it depends on the weekly stories in virology, what's hot, what's going on in the news. We pick some interesting research papers and just talk about them. And our audience is growing. We do weekly picks just like the Twit Network does in Leo. We have a weekly podcast, a weekly blog, and a weekly book, all science-oriented. And it's our way of expanding the field of good podcasts and good online media so that everyone knows more about them.
And you've been teaching at Columbia for a number of years.
I've been at Columbia since 1982, right, and I have a laboratory. We do research on viruses. I also teach, and I've done a lot of teaching, and I'm doing more and more, and I'm going to increase my teaching. I really want to reach out and give back to people everything I've learned about viruses. I know an awful lot, and the podcast and my blog also, virology.ws, is another way that I explain viruses to people. I have a lot to contribute, and I think the internet is the best way to do this.
So you're extending your classroom to an...
You're absolutely right. You know, Mark, this is the neat thing. When I make a blog post or I put up a podcast, I get feedback. I get people asking questions. I've had more people ask me questions from the podcast and the blog than I ever had in all the courses I've ever taught in 30 years.
You know, I think it's an amazing thing that people can get, you know, the equivalent of an Ivy League experience through podcasts.
Absolutely. You know, many universities put their courses online now in iTunes University.
Though I have to admit, there's some talent that comes out of those, the lectures. And This Week in Virology is more, definitely more along the lines of what we see on This Week in Tech, in that it has incredible scientific integrity. You guys know what you're talking about. But it also is far more interesting because it's the way you guys cover the material. It's a lot more fun. So I would recommend that people go to iTunes and go under the category medicine and look at This Week in Virology. It's definitely a fun one because viruses are so they're how do you say it? They're pretty scary. I mean,
they're scary, but they're also amazing, right? Combining the both worlds. I mean, as Peter will say, or he said, this is a wrap up. As Peter said, viruses are generally bad, and that's true, but they do amazing things. And the more you learn about viruses, the more people learn about viruses, the more they're fascinated with them.
So there's always a story of good and evil.
You know, there are some good viruses too. Really? There are some viruses do good things. Yes. So for example, there's some very pretty tulips in Holland that wouldn't be as colorful if they didn't have a certain plant virus infecting them.
Well, if you want to hear more, as I said, go to This Week in Virology. So thank you very much for coming on.
It was my pleasure. And if you ever need a virologist at a future show, I'm happy to come back.
I think we're going to do a few more.
And Mark, I'd like to have you on TWIV one day, and you can ask innocent questions about viruses.
That'd be fun. I'll definitely be there. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Before we go, I'd like to thank Phil Peltzy and Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. I'd also like to thank the team at Pause and Print, who've been producing the transcripts to this show, I think since episode 27. They've been doing a fantastic job. They can handle even the most technical material. So for those transcripts, you can get them at futuresinbiotech.com. I'd also like to thank Dane Golden and Leo Laporte for co-producing the show. And lastly, if you have any comments or suggestions, I can be reached at mark@twit.tv. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltzy. Thanks for listening.